keep going.
That's live.
Hit it.
We're in. Swig of coffee. Thank you, Michael, for making me an absolutely delicious cappuccino, I think it is. Is a flat white? What is it? What'd you make?
More of a cappuccino. Yeah. I guess, well, cappuccino and a latte. It's somewhere in between.
Yeah.
But, oh, there's Lena.
Yep.
She's grinding some
beans. Grinding the beans.
The beans are a little old. You have to really time your beans properly. They're good about 14 days after the roasting date.
And then
if you really want to do it right, you can like put them in a vessel and freeze them.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah, I walked in this morning asking Michael a question about the difference between tamari and soy sauce because I said he's a sophisticated connoisseur of the in the food realm.
Yeah,
he didn't know the difference between them, and we're still unsure. Mm-hmm. But you know, you just showed again why I consider you a sophisticated connoisseur.
Yeah, man,
because you care deeply. I know with pizza you talk about the particular kind of dough,
yeah,
the particular kind of flour that's used, the water that's used, the pH of the water, how all that gets, what kind of leaveners you're using, you know, your yeast is,
man,
how long you...
Sometimes I get depressed. And what are you laughing at? Because I'm it's a problem. I have to research all this crap and man, like, it's just so much stuff. There's so much stuff out there, but then, you know, you can't take it with you in the afterlife. You just get to know it here. And it's like, well, what's all that about? I don't know. It's a dark outlook, but like I'm constantly feeling, like this is more of an emotion. I'm feeling like I have to know. Like, when's the last time you woke up and had to learn how to do like 3D CAD work? Like, I don't know why that happened. Like, I don't know why I need to learn how to color grade like a cinematographer. And I don't know why it bothers me that I'm not good enough, because it holds zero relevance in the history of my life. I'm not going to make any money from it. I'm not going to turn it into a career. It's kind of a hobby, but mostly the hobby is just acquiring useless bits of knowledge across the board. And it's a problem.
And here we are. In this episode, specifically,
let's acquire useless knowledge.
Adding new useless knowledge into your brain.
Yeah, I have to know about track and field.
Yeah. So, Michael, I went back and listened to our episode last week.
How was it?
It was disjointed, confusing, and entertaining.
Yeah, that's good.
So,
it's got all the elements of a great rock and roll song.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed was your curiosity bubbling over and my need for order and categorization to clarify. I overwhelmed the conversation with my trying to get clear on the concept and the idea. So, and you'd asked such great, wonderful questions and ones I think that our listeners will really want to hear. So just for your knowledge, and then maybe for anybody who listened to that first episode and was cringing every time I came on.
No.
I'm gonna try to keep my ordering of this just to the necessity that we need for clarity and understanding. Because I think I was over obsessing about how accurate we were, because thinking about it from a connoisseur perspective, that I'm worried that people aren't going to understand some kind of small little nuance that really isn't important. And whatever questions you ask are probably the right questions because you're learning how to be a fan.
No, I think it was a nice balance. I think it was a nice balance because if we talk too much in generalizations, then it doesn't leave a foundation for the historical context. So I think that a mixture between my ignorance and your kind of excellence in the subject is a nice little cocktail.
Cool.
Because the whole point is, I had a little bit of a breakthrough this week. I was explaining to people on the group run. I said, "Are y'all into track and field?" You know, and I think every run this week I started talking about track and field, and I was like, "Did you know that there's something called the Diamond League?" And we only have, it's like kind of like football in Europe. Like, yeah. It's a thing. It's
very
weird.
Much just football.
It's like,
that's where it came from. That's where the idea came from.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. I'm kind of into it. I tried to watch that track meet this weekend on Saturday, but I'm glad you turned me on to the fact that Flow Track puts them on YouTube the day after. Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was cool, man.
Yeah.
I'm about a four. I went from a two to a four.
Cool. Well, let's jump in here with, we're going to talk about the 10,000 meters. I have a basic structure I'd like to kind of think about, and I'm just going to open up with that, and then we'll see where we go. Yeah. So I want to describe the 10,000 meters, what it is,
mm-hmm.
how long it's been around, basically. Then I want to jump into how you qualify for it for the Olympics and how that works from the Olympics. And then I want to talk a little bit about the history of the sport, like history of the event and what's going on with that contextually.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally go through the most recent major championships to kind of set you up for being excited about what's going on this spring and in the summer.
And yeah, I think we need to talk about the eras too, because I think from a
layperson,
you know, you'll hear all these names. You know, you'll just hear names and you're like, they're important. And I know they are important in the history of running. I just don't know why. It's like, okay, cool. That's nice to know.
And in this, what's really interesting about the 10,000 meters is that these athletes' careers were at the 10,000 meters. Let's take the perfect person is Haile Gebrselassie or Kenenisa Bekele, who then moved up to the marathon and were relevant. And Kenenisa Bekele just ran the New York City half this weekend. And, you know, he recently almost broke the world record 2 years ago. And, you know, he's in his 40s. So,
How do you say 30s. His last name?
Bekele.
Bekele. Yeah, I don't want to mispronounce mm-hmm. it, but I've heard this name quite a bit.
And so
but also
good.
In the road running scene. So,
he's considered the world's greatest 5,000, the greatest distance runner in the world based on results mm-hmm. across the board, taking 5K through the marathon and including cross country races. He's won more national titles, and to the point that it's like he's almost double the points that anybody else has. It's pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think everybody considers him necessarily the finest and greatest. They think of him as a great performer, but he didn't have a lot of races. He was so far ahead of everybody. He broke the world records in his events pretty handedly. It's kind of like what Kipchoge was in the late teens, right?
Mm-hmm.
When Kipchoge finally took over, up until 2020, 2021, nobody could even beat him, and it was almost getting boring. And that's how it was for Bekele.
And he's like 40 and still...
Correct.
He was racing.
We're going to talk about that when we talk about the five, for
yeah.
sure, because there was a race between the world's best 1,500-meter runner, the world's best 10,000 and 5,000-meter runner. At the 5,000-meter distance, Kipchoge was in that race, and he won a world championship and then got second or third at the Olympics as those three competed, which is, like, in my opinion, the greatest era in the history of the sport, of the modern era of the sport, because the three greatest very rarely go up and down in distance mm-hmm. at the same time, and we saw some epic battles there. But
well, tell me about the 10K.
So the 10K is 25 laps around the track at the track and field at all of these things. So it's 25 laps around the track. And the next longest race is the 5K, which is half of that, which is 12 and a half laps. So there's a pretty different, many people believe that there's a pretty different physiological ask of the 10K. However, if you look at the history of the sport or the history of performances, I mean, a lot of the time, the best in the world at the 5K is the best in the world at the 10K at the same time. And you'll see this in the Olympics.
Wait, so the best in the world at the 5K is also the best at the 10K?
Very, very often. And okay. So there's the area where I said, is the 10,000 redundant last week when we talked about it? It's because there has been a push to try maybe consider getting rid of the 10,000 because of the sameness of it. But I think this is very akin to getting rid of the 100 and keeping the 100 and getting rid of the 200. You do see sometimes...
And then there's the 60 if you're an indoors.
Yes, there's that too.
Some bullshit, if you ask me.
Yeah, but But it's a separate event. And so what they're doing is sometimes in track and field is trying to limit the number of people that are participating or make it more exciting for, and the 10,000, because it does take, you know, 30 minutes, 25 to 30 minutes.
Yeah.
It is a bigger ask it's of people's attention. Helping. Yeah. And like I said to you,
and
I
they don't even get started till about 15 to 17 minutes.
Which is why I sent you that, which is a lot of people's argument. That's where the redundancy argument is very, very clear, because they do tend to make the race a 5K with just 5K before it. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's argued for redundancy, and I totally see that point. But I do think that
it'd be a shame.
It would be, but I think the ask of the 10K is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But I do see why people say that. So it's 25 laps around a track, 6.2 miles. So 0.2 is basically 400 meters. So it's basically six miles. So six times four laps, right, mm-hmm. for a mile, or 1,600 meters. And then they kick for the last 400 meters.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, historically, especially as you've watched, you watched three or four.
Is always on 400? Because it seems like some start around six.
This is the strategy. Depends on where people place it and how far out they want to go and different ways of doing
it. Define the kick.
So a kick, for people who want to know, is the final run-up to the finish line.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's usually, almost all of us know this intuitively. If we're running any distance beyond 100 meters, we're going to try to pace ourselves and try to go out pretty quick, but then try to finish really quick. And the finishing quick is called a kick.
Has anybody ever reversed that strategy and tried to lose? I mean, being a front runner would be kind of a disadvantage, but has anybody ever tried to?
So the greatest practitioner of what you just stated is a gentleman called Mo Farah.
Yeah,
who many
UK,
people know,
but he was from
Somalia,
East
of Africa. Yeah, and he and his coach was Alberto Salazar. So he
ran for Nike,
and he knew he wasn't the best kicker. I mean, he ran a 3:29, 1500, which is very, very fast.
Played the weighted average and ran the whole thing just fast.
He and his coach created a strategy by which they stretched people out from about eight laps out. So he would get to the front about eight laps out. Sometimes he would wait to six. It just depended. But as soon as he got to the front, he would start grinding. Now, there's another athlete that does the same thing. His name is Jakob Ingebrigtsen. And we'll be talking a lot about him when we talk about the 1500 and the 5K. He's mostly a 1500-meter runner that many people recognize him as, but he's actually had more success at the international level at the 5K because he operates the same way that Mo Farah did, which is a long grind from a long way out that tries to sap out the sort of creatine-based quick pop, like absolute bam that happens in a race. Mm-hmm. And as you become a fan of the sport, you'll begin to recognize the way these races are playing out mm-hmm. in terms of strategy, and you'll get really excited as you see these things play out in different ways.
Sure.
And how the gears change and what happens and how that works. So that's the basics of the 10K. 25 laps around the track, double the distance of the 5K, which is the next race distance. Of course, and when we talk about the Olympics, the next distance beyond that is the marathon, which is 20 miles and then a 10K. So mm-hmm. it's very, very different physiological ask, an absolute different physiological ask. And then I want to go into, so let's talk about how you get qualified for the Olympics, because this is important.
Yeah, I had a question about, I mean, at first glance, it seemed like the world athletic standard was 27 minutes this year.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm watching the Olympics, the previous cycle, and they're running like 27:11 and 27:12 and 13. I'm like, well, why is the standard better than a gold medal at the previous Olympics? What's going on?
Because they're basing a standard on the overall performance basis of the median, I don't know which one they use, you know, those two mathematical terms, for what was the average for the place of the number of entrants they're going to put in the race. So that's a little confusing, I know, but
we're talking about four attempts at under 27 for Americans, or four successful sub 27s prior to this race this past weekend.
But the world standard is 27 minutes.
It's crazy. So yeah.
It's this year is disproportionately crazy, and that's why I want to talk about
it.
But it is important for people to realize that the Olympic standard in this particular distance is different comparatively to the other races. And
the 10K, I think, as opposed to 5K and under.
Yes, yeah. Because as I said to you in a text, the thing that's really critical to understand is they go what we call a straight final at the Olympics. There's no preliminary round. There's no heats. There's, because the race is so long and the physical ask is so high, you do one race. So they limit the number of people on the starting line to 27. I think I told you 18 before, but it's the number is 27. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of bodies to have on the track. But they recognize...
Is that where they'll put like two, like the first four lanes and then the second four lanes, and then they let them merge after around 400 or 200, whatever it is? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. So the reason why they're doing that is because the way that you get qualified for the Olympic Games in the in the 10K is they use 50% of the field, 50% of the value comes from your time, how fast you run, and 50% of the value comes from your the number of points you've scored in competition.
Is this, all right, so this is specific to the 10K.
Specific to
the 10K. Not to the 5K or anything. Just this is to the 10K mostly.
There are some similarities, but because there's a straight final, the challenges around the 10K are much greater to getting a good field and to make sure there's not so much lapping of the field and those kinds of things.
And your best time can come from a national championship. It can come from a world championship. It can come from any sanctioned race.
Correct. Any sanctioned race.
World athletic sanctioned race.
They're even using the roads to get that because they'll do...
Really?
This is very interesting. Joshua Cheptegei, who you watched, and Kajelka, who you watched, they just ran a little road race in Spain, in Laredo, Spain, and they both just got the Olympic standard on the road. It's harder to get on the road.
Prior to this race.
The same weekend.
Oh, really?
The same weekend, because they needed qualifiers. And so now Cheptegei didn't need one. I think he'd already had one. But they have to get that qualifier. So you can also use road races because they're using a point system as well. So it's a combination of points and times, and they're trying to limit the field, which is why it's incredibly competitive and why it's harder to get into the 10K comparatively than the other events.
Is it disproportionately get more airtime?
No. And that's another whole... It gets way less. It's not as valued an event, which is...
Oh, that's interesting. I would have thought...
No, it's not.
I would have thought different.
Even within the distance running community, you have many people who are diehard track and field fans who love the 1500 and the 5K and they hate the 10K.
What?
There are a lot of people who are...
Really?
That way,
I wouldn't have thought that.
Which is why I think it
could
go away.
Coming from a distance runner myself, a hobby distance runner.
I think
runner.
So many people have seen the races come down to a kick. Mm-hmm. And so they're wondering, why are we spending more time? If we've already got a challenged... We're challenged in getting people to think.
It's a lot of broadcast time.
And they don't broadcast. And they, you know, this is the thing about television, and you'll hear track fans all the time talk about it when you follow. If you, you know, this is a whole nother conversation around TV, around how TV works and how TV functions. But on race day, as the race is going on, they're exactly the same. But in terms of what they show on the television, there's a difference. So, so the qualification
cut to the
is.
High dive.
Yeah, the qualification is you've got to get the highest number of points you can, and then the Olympic standard is a really important thing. But there will be many people on the starting line. There will be probably more people on the starting line without the Olympic Olympic qualifying standard than have the Olympic qualifying standard.
Wait a second.
Because you don't absolutely have to run that, because they're going to use that number combined with points to fill out a 27-person field.
Wait. So they have a standard, but you don't necessarily have to hit it to be on the starting line?
If you hit the standard, you're absolutely guaranteed to get to the starting line. That's why it's so aggressive.
So what about somebody who hits the standard but doesn't have the points, and then somebody who has the points that doesn't hit the
standard? The points only are only relevant if you haven't hit the time standard.
Okay, so priority one is the standard.
Then
that's why the standard is fairly aggressive, because they have a limited field.
Not even fairly. It's like incredibly aggressive.
Yeah, and it's super aggressive. But that being said, if 20 people hit the standard, they got 20 spots, and then they look to times plus points to fill the other spots.
Correct. Gotcha. Now, there's one other clarification to make around that that's really important. Each country can only send 3 athletes.
Yeah.
So in Kenya and Ethiopia, you may have already 30 people who have gone under the standard, but they can only send 3. And they'll either do that through a, like the U.S. does, through a first, second, or third at their national championship, or they'll select it like they do in Ethiopia, where they'll select their team based on, a, they'll have a mixed thing where they'll have a race, and then they'll have some selection so that they can try to put the best athletes on the field. For the U.S., why it's so important for all those athletes to get the Olympic standard is if they get that Olympic standard and they get in the top three, they are absolutely on the starting line at the Olympics. Because of the national,
so it's safe the way to say from that race, it seems like we have two.
We have two, three guaranteed.
Is it two? Yeah, I know that Nico and Grant Fisher.
Grant and Nico, absolutely. No, so did what's his name? So did Woody Kincaid.
Okay.
Woody kicked into that field, so he got under 27. So we've got three Americans. So if, let's say that somebody else, Joe Klecker was in that race too, and he got dropped off the back. He ran 27.
I remember that. That was early, probably.
A little earlier than people thought, but then he ended up finishing his time in like 28.07 or 28.10, so he still ran very, very fast.
Okay.
I mean, sorry, 27.07 or 27.10. So he's still very fast, but he's going to have to rely on the points in order to get him in. So he's going to need to be in that top 27 athletes based on time and points to get him in because he didn't hit it.
Oh,
and the U.S.
Okay.
is only, and the U.S. is going to privilege 1, 2, and 3 up until a certain point. And this is really confusing. This is the part that's so frustrating. It has been for many years for many people. When you watch, and the 10,000, it doesn't impact as much because there are so few 10,000 meter races available around the world during a season. Which is why this race that we just watched in Southern California happening in the U.S. is why it was so crucial and critical for people who wanted to get those times, is they were able to get them in a controlled environment. Mm-hmm. And there's very few opportunities to get those. But in the other events, in any event, once they're trying to fill the field, some athletes in the U.S., let's say that you got second at the Olympic trials and there's, and you beat out a guy who's fourth at the Olympic trials, but he has the standard. You have the opportunity, based on your country's decision-making, on to chase a standard. So you would have another opportunity to try to go under 27 minutes. And if you did, because you got second, they're going to privilege that. The U.S. privileges your first, second, and third at the Olympic trials primarily, whereas other countries use a variety of different ways to fill out their fields to get them on the starting line. But the reason why that's important in terms of thinking about the other countries is that Ethiopia can only send three athletes. Kenya can only send three athletes. The United States can only send three athletes. And this allows that 27-person field to have more diversity. And especially at the Olympics, they really want other countries to be able to be on the starting line because the whole idea around the Olympics is participation.
Yeah, I'm wrapping my brain around this. There's like 270 countries?
Yes.
Something like that? 273? Yes. Something like that? And that would be like, you know, it's almost 700 and change. So it's like that's a big 10K field. So the World Athletics would prefer, I would assume, to see more representation in countries, right?
They won't. No, I think the World Athletics is really, really committed to, primarily the organizing committee is really, really interested in having the best track and field meets that we can possibly have. However, they're in the Olympic cycle, and because the Olympics and the four-year cycle we talked about last time and the importance of that, because that's so high in the Olympic value, the Olympics is different from the World Championships. The Olympics, they value more representation. So you end up seeing athletes on the course, on the feet, on the track that may not need to be, that may not may be there. But the World Athletics has said to the Olympic Governing Committee, which is a little bit different than the world one,
let's take the best.
They say, let's take the best, so we're going to create the standards. And so they said you have to get under the time standard or have the points. So you won't have some Jerry Jogger mm-hmm. out there from, you know, the tiniest little island in the Pacific who has who can run 32 minutes or can't even break 32 minutes getting in the race and getting mixed up. So they've tried to stop that. And I think that that's good for the sport. I don't think there's anything wrong with that because the Olympics are now very much professionalized. They're not amateur like they used to be, but they're still trying to lean into the spirit of fairness. And the other thing is there's athletes who are just really, really good at cross country. And the World Athletics really supports cross country as a separate discipline. And they want those cross country racers to have an opportunity, because sometimes somebody who's really good on the cross country is not as great on the track.
Sure.
And so they're trying to figure out a way to try to balance all that. And it makes for a confusing selection process and a qualification process. That's why I wanted to take a few minutes just to open that door and say, it's a little complicated, but don't worry. When you watch the race in Paris, there'll be 27 men and 27 women on the starting line, and that shit's going to get after it like a house on fire. Now, another question you said is, well, why are they running at the World Championships slower than the Olympic standard? And that's because these races are run for two reasons. The races are races. They're not time trials. And so first, second, and third place get the medals, no matter how fast or slow they run on that day. And we know by watching strategic other events, sometimes people go out really fast, sometimes people go out really slow.
So it's more about the kick.
Or the strategy.
It's more about the competition than it is about the best time.
The time doesn't really matter as much.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of money in the Olympics. So there's a lot of money in terms of winning the Olympics. There's a lot of money in sponsorships around the Olympics, because many people's sponsorship plans have some kind of...
That's why if you do like a world record attempt...
Don't do it at the Olympics.
It might be in a controlled environment with pacers and shit.
Yeah, you see it a lot. Yeah. And you also see it that way because we saw the wave lights are really, really big help. And there are no wave lights at championship meets. So it's just...
These wave lights seem to have... Man, at first it seems like cheating. It seems like a disadvantage. I don't know how I felt about that. Seemed a little biohacking kind of an idea.
And, this is technology. This is the question we have around technology.
And I'm like, all right... It weirded me out seeing the wave lights.
You watched Cheptegei. I've showed you a video of Cheptegei running basically completely. He had a pacer, and then the pacer fell off. Then he was all by himself running with lights in Valencia during a pandemic. And there was nobody even in the stands, if you notice. Like, nobody was even allowed to watch. Yeah. So it was like this weirdly weird situation that many people really got grumpy. I mean, Joshua Cheptegei, who we'll be talking about in this episode.
He's amazing.
Everyone loves him, but people got a little sour on him because of that. But he just wanted the world record. And he was like, and he was in a pandemic year, and everybody didn't have anything to do, and he's like, make it work for me.
So they made
it work for him, and they've allowed it, just like they've allowed the super shoes. Like, some people are really still upset about super shoes, and now we have super spikes. How are those impacting the way things are going? What I say is eventually the technology is there, I think, because humans like to see technological advances and we like to see the sport grow. So to me, it's pretty cool. But if they had wave lights at the Olympics or at the World Championships, it would really be a bad deal.
Okay, I'm glad to hear that.
It doesn't exist at the championship events. At the U.S. Championships, at the Olympic Trials, at the World Championships, and at the Olympic Games, they don't have them. However, at the Diamond League races, absolutely have them.
Diamond League.
Because that's where they're trying to run really fast.
That's the funny one to me. Yep. I'm going to figure out this Diamond League thing. It's kind of a goofy name. It's a goofy name for a series.
It is.
Diamond League.
It's a little elitism going on there. But anyway.
In case you're wondering, the Steve Prefontaine Classic is the only U.S. soil Diamond League race. That's one of my new fun facts when I'm talking track and field, talking shop with the boys.
Yeah, so I think that's good around the qualification. So let's talk a little history. Women didn't get to compete in the 10,000 meters until 1988, which is ridiculous, but it is what it is, okay? But prior to that, there's a whole history of the 10,000 on the men's side. We start with the Flying Finns from the early 1900s through the 1920s. They were world famous, and the 5,000 and the 10,000 were probably the most popular track and field races. Some of the most popular, they were equally popular as the 100 and the 200 back in that day, because the Flying Finns were so interesting. Paavo Nurmi was the head one, but there was a number of other ones, and they basically swept all of the awards from the 5,000 to the 10,000 to the marathon for probably four Olympiads. So that's the Flying Finn era.
Were they Finnish?
They were all Finnish. Yes, they were from the land of Finland. And, you know, what's really interesting now, we've got a Norwegian resurgence, but Norwegians have had only come onto the stage nationally really on the men's side, they've really only come on the stage nationally, on the world stage, let's say in the 2010s and beyond. On the women's side, we've had really high quality Finnish women for a much longer period of time. Mm-hmm. Norwegian women from a much longer, Greta Weitz and Ingrid Christensen, two incredible, great marathoners, two of history's greatest marathoners were from that country. And so then we move to the next era, which is what I would call the Emil Zatopek era. And Zatopek is a much beloved character.
What is this, around the 50s?
This is in the 50s. He's a Czechoslovakian, and he was, there's some controversy around him, around his support of some draconian and terrible regimes in Czechoslovakia. But I think other than that, sort of like that's sort of a revisionist history thing that's going on. But he was so well loved by so many people because he was so kind and such a great sportsman. And he really elevated the quality of the sport. He's the first and only athlete in the history of distance running to win the 5,000, the 10,000, and the marathon in the same Olympic Games.
That's ballin'.
There's only one.
I like that.
He's the only person that's ever done it, and likely the only person who ever will.
What's his name?
His name's Emil Zatopek. And one of the things about Zatopek that's super interesting is he had the worst facial features and biomechanics. From the hips down, he was a beautiful runner, but from the hips up, he used huge body English,
swinging.
His face grimaced. Yeah. He looked like he was dying.
Yeah.
And he just galvanized the public's interest in the event.
Mm-hmm.
And he had really unconventional training methods. He would do repeats. This is just as they were starting to get the idea of doing repetitions as a preparation for marathon, for track and field races. He would do repetitions on a trail in his native Czechoslovakia. His wife was a thrower. She was a shot putter or a discus thrower. I can't remember. But he would ask her to put all their clothing in a tub, and he would run in place and do a workout in place with the clothes in the tub and run. Just these really interesting, mm-hmm. iconic sort of image of him.
How long does a career like this last for a guy like that?
His was about 10 years, probably.
Would you say that the average career is maybe 8 to...
I'd say 8 to 10. When you add the collegiate, you know, when we talk about the collegiate athletes, sometimes it's a little longer or a little shorter, depending. But for most of these athletes, we're seeing them rise up at the junior level or the collegiate level, and then extending that another... usually two Olympiads, sometimes a third, but usually two. Then the next era that we have is the era of Lasse Virran, another Finn.
Yeah, and he was with the Prefontaine
era. Correct.
So Lasse Virran was what, in the
1972, 1976. Mm-hmm. And of course, 1980 is a totally scrambled year because of the many boycotts that happened around it. But and he was renowned. It was just the era where we first started talking, where doping first starts getting thought of in the sport, because athletes were blood doping, which means that they would go to a high elevation location, train for a while, pull blood out while they're up there with a high, really, really high levels. And they would freeze it and hold it, and then they would go to sea level right before the race, and they would get a blood transfusion before the race started. Right now, there's no one, I think, consider that. But there's no one who would consider that weird or that off from a performance standpoint. But back in the 70s, this was before we started having serious drug cocktails, before mm-hmm. the pharmaceutical companies started going off and then started creating all this stuff. But, you know, at the time...
Then it probably wasn't... It was more like, damn, that's kind of smart.
Or some people were really, really angry because not everybody had access to that kind
of
technology.
Right, right. It's like, damn.
Yeah.
They're really going...
But already in the 70s, we start to get this little tinge of drugs that starts to come into the sport. That's not really drug related, but it's more towards like, what are we using medical? We're using a medical technology to try to advance our ability that others can't do that.
The cross-section of, you know, pharmaceuticals and medication and technology was also coinciding with, you know, like... we were just coming up with like general MIDI and synthesizers and shit and see what that happened to music. So it was like same thing with running was like,
so
okay,
correct. We've what got a great analogy.
Different ideas kind of converging around the 70s and 80s were dynamic for pretty much everything where technology drives the culture of an event.
Yes, it set a lot of the stage for what we were going to allow and allow to happen in the future. Okay. But Lasse Virran is the last person to attempt the triple. So he tried to do the 5K, 10K marathon at the 1976 Olympics, mm-hmm. and he was famously first in the 5, famously first in the 10, and then he was 5th at the Olympics in the marathon and did not, and that was the last athlete that tried to do this triple. We've never seen it attempted again.
Which distance did he consider himself to be the strongest at?
I would probably say he would have thought he was, well, let's just, this is where this question about,
it's like, are you a 10K runner and can do the 5K and then the marathon, or are you a 5K runner that can beast out the marathon?
So I think he only ran the marathon that one time. I don't know that he ever ran it again. So, you know, he only did it because of Zatopek. He only did it because of the highest standard that's ever been set by an Olympic, sure. in the Olympic Games mm-hmm. before. But I think he was a better 5K runner, but he was not a very good 1500 meter runner. But he was very hard to beat in the 5K because of the way he raced it was very much the way Ingebrigtsen does it and the way that Mo Farah did it. He would do a long extended push. And that's just a race that, the 1972, the race that some people who are big Prefontaine fans, you probably have seen video footage of Lasse just
pulling away,
controlling the mm-hmm. pace from about 600 meters out and just stretching and stretching and stretching the more aggressive, you know, geary shifts that somebody like Prefontaine had.
He went as low as the 1500?
Well, they would run 15s occasionally, but he was not like, I mean, Prefontaine at his heyday was a 15.5 guy. So he was 15 miler and a 5K guy. And that's another topic we can talk about at some point of who runs the 5, but I would like to save that for the 5K.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think if Lasse Virran won the 5K, he was going to destroy you in the 10 because he could just make you suffer so much. The other thing about Lasse Virran that's really interesting, and he has a little bit of tinge around the idea, people sometimes don't give him the credit that he deserves. One, because of the potentiality of blood doping, and he's never actually been implicated in any way around it, but it was just part of what people were saying. But more, it was that he did not perform particularly well at any other events, nor did he really give a shit. Now, this was pre-World Championships, so all he cared about was the Olympic Games. So he was on the stage in 1972, off the stage for 2 years.
What on was the his stage nationality?
He's Finnish. He was also from Finland. He was a police officer, too.
Yeah,
so.
And he was probably on that Finnish payroll was like, go get the Olympics.
But this is still the era where people, professionalism was just coming into the sport. So a lot of people were working other jobs. He was a police officer.
He was a cop.
Yes.
And I wouldn't want to be chased down by.
Yeah. So, an
Olympian cop.
So he really just showed up at the Olympics. And so sometimes that's part of his aura, but also something that some people take away from
him. Yeah.
So then the next era is the era, what I would call, well, the big era is just East and North African dominance after this
point. You mentioned prior that 76 and 80 were kind of when East Africa was showing up to the Olympics with kind of a disproportional, like, medal. Like,
no, they were equals. So they went from non-existent mm-hmm. through the late 60s and early 70s and into the early 80s. I think that we started to see some athletes competing. We had a variety of athletes at a variety of distances, but they were one or two, just like you had one or two Belgians, one or two Americans, one or two Finnish athletes, one or two Moroccans. That's what you usually saw. But what happens from 1984 to 1988 and beyond, and after 1988, I had the stats I sent to you.
Mm-hmm.
After 1988 at the Olympic Games.
It was 88, yeah.
Well, let's do the World Championships. From the World Championships started 1987, they started the World Championships. There were a potential 51 medals for competition. 51
and
medals.
You got like 47?
47 of those 51 medals were won by someone from North or East African descent. So Morocco or Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, or Uganda recently. We've had Ugandans. But in that era, so you've got, you know, a very small, especially when you think about how close all the East Africans are, they are very, very close.
My geography is shit. What's going on with the north, south, and west?
So much of the east, let's talk about the east of Africa, the west of Africa is where most of our sprint, where many, many sprinters come from. And many of the sprint stars in Jamaica and the U.S. Mm-hmm. are a product of the slave trade that came across in the 1600s and the 1700s in the New World, where many of those Nigerians, Gabon, Ivory Coast, all those areas, many of them came over because of the slave trade, and then they became Jamaicans, and then mm-hmm. they became Americans, and many of them are of West African descent. Mm-hmm. And so you have, the sprints are primarily dominated from people of West African descent.
Okay, we'll
and the distances and the distances yeah. are primarily dominated by Africans of people of East African descent. And the North Africans are important just because Morocco has had a particular focus on it. And Morocco and Algeria are both really big questionable, very, very questionable for very, very long periods of time around doping. So okay. they've got systematic state-sponsored sport that is a little bit questionable over many, many years. But though, yeah. but it is still crazy to think that since 1987, 47 out of 51 championship opportunities in the 5,000 to win a gold, a silver, in the 10,000 to win a gold, a silver, or a bronze, 51 opportunities, 47 of them were of North African or West African, East African descent. Of the four that I mentioned, three of those were Mo Farah, who's Somalian descent, but was raised in the UK. So right there you have like, and the only other one in the 10,000 who's ever scored a medal at the world championship level, like there were only two others. Like, and the same thing that we see at the Olympics, the numbers at the Olympics are also the same way. It's just after 1988, the entirety of the sport is dominated by primarily Kenyan and Ethiopian athletes with some Moroccans. And now recently we've seen Uganda come on really, really strong. So that's the main era that we have now. Within that era, we've got two great Ethiopians we have to talk about. Mm-hmm. Haile Gebrselassie, many, many people have seen him run. He's a tiny, diminutive little Ethiopian guy who had unbelievable wheels. And he was someone who also tried the 5, the 10, and the marathon, but he couldn't pull it off because it just couldn't happen. He was the last one to even make an attempt at it, but he didn't succeed very well. Mm-hmm. But he and another athlete from Kenya named Paul Turgot had a classic battles for many, many world championship and Olympic battles of dominance. But Haile Gebrselassie typically won. And then in the aughts, as we get into the aughts, we move into the era of Kenenisa Bekele, who basically completely controlled all of 5,000, 10,000. He had the 5,000 world record, 10,000 meter world record. He won the world cross country championships at the short and the long distance, and he won everything. He went out and ran, and he won. He is considered by many as the greatest distance runner in the history. In history.
When you say distance running, this is a stupid question. How far are we talking?
I would go, that would place you from the 800 to the marathon.
Okay.
I would put
as
that
low as the 800.
Yeah, he because there it's so much harder to be dominant,
yeah.
and there are so many fewer opportunities to compete. So world championships and cross country skewed a lot of that for him, but he still is considered because he held the world records at the same time, and he won he won the world championships and the Olympics in the 5 and the 10 repeatedly, consistently. And now the new era we have is the era of Joshua Cheptegei, who now has won every major championship in the 5 and the 5 and the 10. Well, what that Jakob Ingebrigtsen's not been in, except for the Olympic Games, which I think you watched that video, where Solomon Berega outkicked him because he was not in the right position at the right time to mm-hmm. execute the race. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of a historical focus. But what's really interesting now, and this is the reason why I really wanted to highlight getting you to be a fan, is we're seeing something really unusual. We're seeing Frenchmen. We're seeing Americans. We're seeing Japanese. We're seeing more athletes be relevant in the 10,000 on the men's and the women's side than we've ever seen before. And so we're now beginning to see where the East African and North African hegemony of control, of winning everything, is now being broken up. Why that is really, really interesting. I think in the United States, I can speak to the quality of coaching that has happened throughout the early aughts, that great coaches are at the high school level now. And so kids are doing much more sophisticated training. The collegiate system is much more geared now towards thinking about being a competitive at the world level. And then technology has leveled the playing field in some ways. The ability to travel, the ability to train at altitude for extended and long windows of time, the recognition of what's going on physiologically with the benefits of altitude have changed the game in a big way. And so I think training and technology changes have shown us are now beginning to level the playing field, where the hegemony of East African and North African control of the sport, of the event of 10,000 meters, is now not there. And I think we have a real good shot having an American be a medalist. Could he win the gold medal in the 10,000? Grant Fisher, who we'll be talking about, potentially. He's going to need a really good day and everything's going to have to line up just right. But he's now got the skill sets to maybe potentially be in that category and actually be knocking on the door. You saw he got fourth.
Was that at Doha?
That was at Eugene.
And
he got fourth at the in the 10,000 at the Eugene's World Championships.
So the World Championships was held in Eugene.
It was held. So we had four. We've had. So let's talk about that too. So pandemic screwed some things up.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about that before. You have a World Championship, a gap year, a World Championship, and Olympic Games. But because of the pandemic, they shifted the Olympic Games from the 2020 to 2021. So we had a gap. We had a 2019. We had Doha World Championships. The crowd was crazy in that race. I showed it to you. There was like thousands of people in the crowd, and they were screaming and yelling. And then the next meet is Tokyo. The next World Championship is Tokyo. And there's nobody in the stands because it's the pandemic, and the Japanese were very, very conservative about how they did that. And then the race, just energy of the whole race was a little bit different. And then 2022, the World Championships were in Eugene, and in 2023, this last year, they were in Budapest.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I saw that race that he got fourth, and that was kind of like blowing everybody's mind.
Yes, it was
like
incredible.
Here's a guy from Michigan.
Yes.
It's like, okay. What's going on here?
And he was also in the 5,000. We'll talk about that next time that we talk about the races. In the 5,000, he was actually almost closer, but he stepped on the rail and got positioned. So, you know, many people have, the knock against Grant Fisher has been his inability to kick. But as you watched in the 10 that you watched, where he outkicked all those guys,
he's got it.
He's got some wheels. Yes.
Would you say? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Keep going. I have one question. Are they talking about the end of the East African era of domination, possibly, by volume? Is it just like, do they just have a way larger pool? Like, it'd be kind of like the difference between, they're probably not so great at like football because they don't have a lot of football players, you know, like American football. Like, it's like, is that the difference? Like, are we talking like just... I know it's a silly question, but is the dominance just from the sheer numbers of people participating in the sport, and America has far few of a cohort of distance runners to compete at that level?
This is a wonderful question, and one I think people don't ask enough, but unfortunately the answer isn't one that can be scientifically proven. So ultimately, my view about this is that there are three contributing factors. Mm-hmm. The first is born and raised at altitude. So everybody in Ethiopia and everybody in Kenya is born and raised at a significant level of altitude. They're basically all born in Denver. Mm-hmm. Whether you're in a valley or you're at a top of a hill, you're
so
at least 5,000.
Is the best area of the country.
So they're correct. So both of those countries are high elevation countries, and there's something about being born at altitude that sort of really changes the human physiology to the benefit in events that are very aerobic. So the 10,000 and the marathon, they're very aerobic. So that's one reason. It's just being born. But you would say, okay, but lots of other people have been born at altitude. There's altitude in Switzerland. There's altitude in the United States and everything else. So it's just one contributing factor. The second contributing factor is the value placed by the culture and the community. Mm-hmm. So in the U.S., we highly prize our American football players, our American basketball players. So any athlete that has any talent level might move into those sports because they're a much greater chance to be a millionaire, to make a lot of money.
Sure.
And then there's also the piece of, like, it's a the idea of team sport versus an individual sport. So many, many young people who might be really good distance runners end up playing soccer and getting involved in, European football or American soccer.
Yeah, a lot of the time you get a fast kid, they like make him a running back.
Yeah, but the thing about football is that the somatotype is not actually optimal for distance running.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have that question of like nobody who was going to be a world, like Galen Rupp, mm-hmm. the one American that we've had prior to Grant Fisher in the modern era, who has been competitive at the 10,000 meters is Galen Rupp, and he was never going to be an American football player. However, Alberto found him while he was coaching his sons. Both his sons were national class soccer players, and Galen was on the soccer pitch with his sons, and he recognized his talent level, and he said, "I'm going to make you into a star," and talked his parents into it. And Galen was willing to move from a team sport into an individual sport and then train pretty aggressively through his high school years with the world's greatest coach at the time. And so he really blossomed into this amazing athlete. That's because cool. of that. But I think there's another part. It's like cultural value and in Ethiopia and in Kenya, after 1972, you can feed a family for a year on the winnings of one small road race. Yeah. So the finances, the cultural finances of a place, it's harder to live in the United States. It's more expensive to live in the United States. It's a little less expensive to live in Kenya. And then the money goes a lot further there. And so there's this, and then the value, your heroes are now sports stars. So now you have generation after generation after generation who see that we now have generations of Ethiopians who are looking at Haile Gebrselassie and Bekele as their heroes, and generations of Kenyans who are looking at Paul Turgot.
Yeah.
And so, and because there's money there,
it's like
there's
they're
opportunity
Michael Jordans
there.
Of their.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And then the final piece, which is a little
That's
bit
cool.
which is yeah. A little bit more controversial. I'm not sure if it's controversial, but it's just another piece of the puzzle that I think plays into it that is important to look at, is just that they're physiologically, so beyond the benefit of being born at altitude, they're also their somatotype is extremely lean, not big boned, and not very densely muscular. And so the human physiology somatotype of them is an ectomorph, we call that, typically. And you do just consistently see the gentlemen and ladies who are the most bird-like, the most thin-boned, and the most lean are incredibly effective at creating power. We'll talk about this with Sifan Hassan, female runner from the Netherlands. And we can see it with Kajelka, who you got to see him run. He was taller, but he's so lean and so thin. Mo Farah was the same way. Very lean, very not dense in muscle. And so the ability to, but they're powerful and able to generate immense amounts of power off of the ground, but they're also light. And so over the course of a 10,000 meter race, that is much greater. It's a lot less cost to the body.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're seeing with the Kenyans, especially like you look at this with Joshua Cheptegei, the Ugandans, and recently the Ugandans have come on strong. Two main Ugandans that we'll be paying attention to are Jacob Kiplimo, who's a younger guy, and then Joshua Cheptegei, who's now won the last two world championships and was second at the Olympic Games in the 5 and the 10. These athletes, this idea of just one basic somatotype is a little off. And we're seeing like Grant Fisher, he's not looking like a bird.
Yeah, he's kind of shorter.
But he's muscular,
and he's
powerful.
For sure. He'd strike me as just a...
And I think this is something that's going on with the shoes. I think the energy return value for the super spikes is creating opportunities that maybe weren't there before, but who knows? So those are the arguments for why we saw the East African grip, and things that are changing are greater understanding of training, greater understanding of the value of altitude and use of altitude.
Yeah.
And then I think in some ways we have a grat thanks to FloTrack, thanks to Runner's Space, we're getting higher profile vision on the high school game in track and field in our country. The collegiate game has gotten to be world class. You're seeing many of the winners of the NCAA championships show up on the world stage and win world championships. So now there's like, oh, let's pay attention to them when they're younger and developing, so we can watch them on the stage when they're Olympians and producing at that level. So we're like tracking them a little bit more. And because of that, they've got a chance, a better chance at making a livelihood out of the sport itself. And then the way the sport has changed, the way the world has changed in terms of being able to be, you know, an influencer or having the ability to generate revenue through other means. You know, like the Coffee Club is a podcast with three members of the On USA On group that's based out of Boulder with Dathan Ritzenheim. And they're generating, they're both, all three of those guys are on a pretty substantial contract that's would easily, probably a six-figure contract, or at least high seven-figure, high five-figure contract for them. But they're also making YouTube money because there's real YouTube money. I mean, say eight-year-olds are making thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars talking about whatever they're talking about. So now even podcasting, because the way that YouTube works, there's many, many more opportunities for getting, generating. And so I think there's a lot, a big difference. And so I, because of all of that, I think we're just seeing the level, the playing field get leveled a little bit more.
Oh man, that's fascinating. Yeah, I think that the shoes are, I think I would imagine that the big question is, do the shoes make everybody better, or do the, does it even it out?
Everybody's better. Everybody has to wear the shoes on in training too, because the thing that's really crazy about super spikes, and I don't know, you know, I don't know all the, you this is your world,
it's
more
basically
than mine.
The difference between them is they're well, for a 10K it's 25 millimeters, and for a 5K it's 20 millimeters is the height. For context, our base model is around 21. But no, not at the thickest. It will be 25. So we basically have it that'd be the highest at a 10K. But they're using the same foams, same plates, and similar rigidity, but not so, like, it's it seems more technical than just a flat plate. There's a lot of getting power from the pronation and ground contact time and everything that that I've been researching, these like distance spikes, and they definitely optimize the distance.
Most of the collegiate coaches that you hear talk about it, because they have been through watching athletes of similar talent throughout these two eras of pre super shoes, post super shoe, what I'm hearing from them is primarily they're really impressed by the ability to recover. So the recovery value of the new spike is the athletes are not as destroyed from their hard interval sessions, and so they're able to come back and back and back with more and greater work. And some of that is because the coaching models have gotten more sophisticated of late, but also because the shoes are helping with the recovery.
Yeah, the ground contact time and the resiliency of the basically the bounce back, not so much as the plushness, but more so the bounce back time.
There's something
help
in
your
the
foot
shoe.
Not be on the ground as like it, your foot's on the ground, you know, maybe for 60% of the time with the shoes than without the shoes. So just having contact on the ground would mean that, you know, less recovery, but it's the same loading throughout the race, just on the chain, but it's fundamentally different.
Yeah,
it's subtle, but it's fundamentally different.
Interesting. But we're not seeing super, I don't think we're seeing the same kind of revolution in on the track that we're seeing in the that we saw in the marathon after 2016. Because I just don't know there's enough time for the shoes to make that much of a difference. And I think they may be making a difference of, you know, not a full second a lap, right? So not 25 seconds difference, but something there. And enough for it to be important to talk about, but I think the greatest benefit is in the training and the ability to come back and bounce back.
Yeah.
Whereas in the marathon, if you just train in regular flats and then you put on a pair of these 5% or whatever these other shoes are, you will immediately see a return. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where if you trained in regular flats and didn't train in the super spike, if you train in regular spikes and not super spikes, you would not get all the benefits that super spikes are providing in the training, and that would be, it wouldn't actually help you as much.
That makes sense, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we didn't get a chance to talk about the women because it's just so hard, but we will in the future. I do just want to mention that in the women's events, we're seeing, in the women's events from a historical perspective, the women's 10,000, the East African and Kenyan dominance is even more extreme. Much less Westerner, I mean, you know, Europeans, Americans making an impact. The numbers are very much similar. There was an incredible, historically, there was an incredible athlete named Tirunesh Dibaba, who's one of the Dibaba sisters. There are three sisters who basically completely wiped out all the records over many, many years at the Ethiopian level. Tirunesh is sometimes called the babyface destroyer because she would win everything. She had the greatest nickname ever because she looked like a little baby.
Yeah, it's awesome.
But she would just destroy people on the track. Since then, we now have a really interesting battle between the Ethiopians, who are really, really dominant, and the Kenyans, who are dominant. But we're seeing more and more others come in. But one of the most interesting characters, many people who are following the sport may recognize the name Sifan Hassan. Sifan is so interesting. She's of Ethiopian descent, but Ethiopia has many different religious and tribal challenges, and politically she had to leave the country. As a Muslim, she had to leave the country. Ethiopia is primarily Christian. She had to leave the country for humane reasons, humanitarian reasons. She lived for a while as a refugee. She finally found a home in the Netherlands, and she's been competing for the Netherlands for all of her career. But she's the first athlete that's really been trying to do the 1500, the 5K, and the 10,000. So the last Olympics, she won two of the three of those events, and she's going to continue to do that. And so we're seeing more and more women now competing, strangely, down one. So some, not just dominant the 5 and the 10, but even stretching it down towards the 1500 in the women's events, which is really compelling and really interesting. The storylines around who will be competitive at the Olympics in the women's 10,000 we'll continue to talk about. But the really cool thing here is you're seeing much, much more flexing. We now have two or three of the very best. Oh, that's what I was going to say about Sifan. Sifan's not just stopped at the 5, at the 10,000. She's running. She could win a medal in the Olympics this year in the 1500 and win a medal in the Olympics in the marathon.
That's what I'm...
like. She's
to me,
so
this is
weird.
The biggest question about the whole thing, which is... I don't even know if there's a question there. It's like they're so different. It blows my mind to even think of an athlete who can do the marathon and then do the 1500. It just seems like
it's never happened in history. This is the first time we've ever seen it.
Okay,
she's now.
When I hear her name, it's usually within road racing.
But that's been recent. In her early career prior to the pandemic, she was known as a world-class 1500 meter runner. Then she moved up to the 5, and then her coaches were just like, well, why not keep going up?
Go to the 10.
Yeah, she was coached by Alberto Salazar for a while, and then when Alberto was disgraced, she picked up the assistant coach that was there. His name's Roberry. And they're just crafting an incredible program for her that allows her the flexibility. And I think this is the thing that I think is so exciting to me about the sport, is that we're now beginning to break down some of the culturally accrued and assumed to be physiological differences between 1500 meter and marathon. And I'm hoping we start to see people move up. I've said this before. I'm really hoping that Grant Fisher will move up to the marathon. I hope he runs New York City Marathon right after the Olympics. And I don't see any reason why he shouldn't. It used to be, oh, if you moved up to the marathon immediately, you would then be, oh, you're not going to have your wheels and not going to have your speed. But that's not true anymore. And the women are destroying that. There's another woman named Letencet Gidey, who is the first woman who ran the 10,000 and the marathon at the same time. She debuted in the marathon, and just that's what got Sifan going. And now we're just seeing more and more women. It's for the first time we may again see a 5,000, 10,000, and marathon repeat like we saw with Zatopek and the attempt by Viren. It would be so exciting in our sport to see that kind of range, and we've now got the athletes who are potentially capable of doing that. It's unlikely we'll see that happen out of an Ethiopian, because the Ethiopians are so competitive that they will not allow one athlete to have all of those opportunities. But because Sifan Hassan competes for the Netherlands, and there are not three women from the Netherlands who can compete at this level, she'll be able to be in whatever event she wants to be in, and they'll select her.
It's blowing my mind because she's from Ethiopia, represents the Netherlands.
Correct.
Training
in the
U.S. coaching system.
She trains in the U.S. and also, but she goes back and forth. She goes to Ethiopia. But yeah, she has a young American coach. Yes.
Which seems like...
It's weird.
I don't. Our that, world is to so, me, that's weird because
it's so cool to me. It's like our world is shifting and changing.
Well, I think that there's a fourth thing that picks up on why the U.S. is even more competitive on the world stage now. And I would say it's not just about the shoes, but it's also about, you know, we have sophisticated data structures, and we have sophisticated ways of peeling apart research studies, and we have I mean, everybody's research studies are worldwide, but at the same time we have the collegiate system, which houses these programs. We're also housing, you know, research facilities, and we have the ability to get granular about data, it seems. I don't know, in comparison to, you know, the Netherlands or Finland or these other places, I'm sure they have great shit there too, but it's like we have an undeniably great academia system, mm-hmm. which produces a lot of clear data that cascades into the coaching, that even though you represent another country, you probably want to come here to get a piece of that data, which is cool. And to me, it seems less, it's very opaque, the lines, in terms of, you know, it's fascinating that you can build a total athlete from a coaching system in the U.S., representation of another country, and then, you know.
What has really changed things is, you know, we kind of bashed on Nike last week, and they deserve some of the grief they've gotten. But if it weren't for the Oregon Project, what mm-hmm. Nike did and how they funded Alberto Salazar's attempt to bring America back to relevance at the world level, which he basically did single-handedly. Yes, he's now been disgraced for that is true, but we cannot deny that without Nike supporting Alberto, I don't think we would see what we see now. Because all of a sudden, as soon as On decided to get in the game, they had somebody, they knew who the best in the world was. And right now, at the world level, it used to be every single world championship and Olympian who came across the finish line in a medal position would be wearing Nike shoes. But now, On has changed that story. And Adidas is changing that story. It used to be Adidas and Nike, but now it's Adidas, Nike, and On, and On has revolutionized it. And On has spent a lot of money supporting training, a very important training group based out of Boulder that is equal. The last world champion in the mile is from the On program. The best 1500 meter, and he's the fourth best 1500 meter runner on his team, and he won the world championships. So it's like On came in and really revolutionized and changed it.
To me, that's coaching.
It's coaching and technology and willingness to invest in the sport. In the long-term support. On hired Dathan Ritzenhain, who came out of the Nike system, benefited greatly from that early years of the Oregon Project. Mm-hmm. But without the Oregon Project, there's no Dathan Ritzenhain competing at that level. And then there's no On that can compete with that. And then there's not more and more divergence in opportunities. Mike Smith is not able to get the kind of quality of athletes at his program at NAU to create more and more opportunities and have a collective that trains and races out of that area. Like we now have a more level playing field that it used to be. Everything was controlled by Nike in such a dramatic way. That's not to just bash on Nike, but just to say Nike did everything in its power for a very long time to keep all the other players out, but eventually they couldn't do it forever. And now we're seeing, I still think we're going to see most of the Olympic gold medals coming from a Nike athlete. But there's a chance that we might see some others who are in them. And that's a big change. Mm-hmm. It's a huge change.
Where's this guy from?
Where's who from?
Ritzen.
Ritzenhain's also a Michiganer. He's originally from Michigan. And then he ran at the University of Colorado. And then he was the best American distance runner. He represented the U.S. at the 10,000, at the 5,000, the 10,000, and the marathon at the Olympic Games. He was one of our great. He was the last great American distance runner pre-Rupp, and he actually watched while Rupp came up. He is considered by 99% of the public to be clean and have always been clean. Of course, he was associated with Alberto's program, and there were questions there at the end. Steve Magnus and some others, and Kara Goucher and others were pointing at potentially illegal doping, and those kinds of things were happening at the out of the Oregon project. None of those allegations have ever stuck. They're all basically rumors and rumors of rumors. And I don't think, while I highly respect Steve Magnus, I still think that I wasn't there. I didn't see what I saw. But to me, you're innocent until proven guilty. What Alberto's guilty of is being inappropriate with athletes. And he's been banned from being inappropriate with an athlete in a way that is just not acceptable to anybody. And while it won't put him in jail, it'll definitely keep him off the track and coaching on the track. And I don't think he should come back. Before, though, when they were saying it was pseudo-doping claims, I was like, he's going to come back and he's going to destroy everybody. But now that we found out that it was more interpersonal than it was a doping question, he's been, you know, and I was a huge Salazar
fan. I bet that was weird. Yeah.
And a very much a defender of him. But once Kara came forward and then we started hearing about what happened there, they're not going to allow Safe Sport will not allow him to come back to coaching. So he will not be allowed to coach at the Olympic trials or at the U.S. championships, nor will he be allowed to do so at the World Championships or the Olympics. So ultimately, for all intents and purposes, his career is over as a coach. But I cannot stress enough that the revolution we're seeing in the sport was funded by Nike and masterminded by Alberto, and we have them to thank for the revolution we're seeing and the big change we're seeing in American distance running today. And, you know, I mentioned this when we had Leo on the episode, but, you know, the University of Texas was a big part of all that process too. And Leo's advantage, it just raised, you know, one of the guys that Leo competed against all through his college career was an NAU athlete named Lopez Lemong, who eventually moved all the way up to the 10,000. And in one of the recent Olympics was there on the shoulders of everybody with 1K to go. So, you know, we've seen that level of competition that group was in the 2004 to 2008 era of American distance running at the collegiate level radically shifted and changed the playing field and brought us into world contention at the NCAA level, which eventually has now brought us into world contention at the Olympic and World Championship level. And it's a great time for Michael Krachik to be a fan of the sport of track and field.
I feel like I'm getting there, man. It's not all just gibberish anymore. A lot of it's making sense.
And we're going to get some races over the, you know, what we'll do is I think we'll wait a couple of weeks and then we'll unpack the 5, and then we'll wait a couple of weeks and we'll unpack the 15. Because I think we want to talk about other stuff too. We don't want to just, I don't think we should just go straight hard on it. But I think what we want to do is then when we see races come up and things that happen, we can start talking about it. And any way I need, because we've set these two big stages, we're going to be able to discuss and talk about things a lot more and a lot better and a lot more clarity. Agreed. Because you have your feet on the ground and you'll be able to ask questions, but you won't be asking some of those really basic questions that really, like you said, really preclude people from being able to be fans because they're really complicated and challenging. And they're not, as you said, they're not discussed on the television. They're not discussed in Let's Runs. Immediate.
They go
hot
straight
takes.
To elite level. Correct. Data. And it's like, what the shit, man?
But now you're going to hear that data and be able to work through it. And so as you're doing your research, anytime you have a question, bring it back to the podcast so you and I can talk about it. And then we'll continue to layer this in as we're going along. So yeah, it's going to be a big tall drink of water early on, like this episode and the last episode. That's why I'd like to wait maybe a week or two before we do the 5K. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the one thing I do want to say just before we finish is I really, really hope to give equal value to the men's races to the women's. I find them to be equally compelling. In fact, in many cases, I find the women's races to be more compelling. And in this episode, we really highlighted the men's races.
And you told me that going in because it was easier to establish the history of it because
Correct.
Women didn't start competing until 88.
Correct. And then it would also be really... Many of the same things that are happening in the men's sport or happening in the women's sport simultaneously. And now we'll be able to, and because one of the things we talked about, my main goals in the first episode was, can we tell the story of the 10,000 meters? The story of the 10,000 meters is exactly the fucking same for the men and the women at the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. They'll just be different players on the stage. But the stage of the 10,000 meters, as we discuss it, we've now set up. We know that it's hard to get into the event. It's a single final, one straight final. And on that race, it's straight no chaser. And they're going to get after for 25 laps. And in the last 5 to 7 laps, it's going to be a goddamn fucking amazing, incredibly exciting. One of those videos, two of those videos I sent to you, Kara Goucher was the announcer. Mm-hmm. Kara is just, and she is a world championship medalist, one of the very few in the 10,000 to have won a medal at the World or the Olympic Championship, Galen Rupp and Kara Goucher. By the way, both coached by Alberto Salazar at the time. So part of that big change that happened that Nike created. But she's gotten so good at her announcing, and now it, she's super exciting. But what I love about Kara is when there's 400 meters to go, and all the bodies are moving, she goes, she tends to fall back into being a fan. And she's not as clear in her directing of what's actually happening on the race, but she's yelling and getting excited and motivated. And just, I love to hear Kara over the last two world cycles that we've seen. She's gotten better and better and better. So that's the other thing, is our announcing is getting better and better. So the storylines are going to be able to be told a little bit better.
It seems like the guys over at, or guys and gals, whoever's putting on sound running, the announcers were, were guys. They sounded young.
That's the flow track crew.
Yeah. So they're to me, it strikes me as a youthful style operation.
For sure.
Their target demographic is probably high school and college.
Yes.
And which is interesting, because I used to think it was like a big flex to get the greatest runners into these races. And I'm like, actually, they're giving, from what I understand now, an event with less bandwidth and less broadcast.
Equality.
The stage.
Yes.
And they're doing a great service to that particular event. Probably will keep it alive.
Well,
you know, through the broadcast narrative.
Well, yes, through the broadcast narrative. But more importantly, I don't know that we can overstate the importance of the 10. This event that happened last weekend in, I forget, it was somewhere in Southern California. Jesse Williams, who basically created the Brooks Beast program in Seattle through Brooks Running, that now has produced the world champion in the 1500 meters and the world champion in the 2 mile at the last world championships, Josh Kerr.
Not to be confused with the Brooks Beast shoe, which is the biggest stability shoe on the market.
Correct. But the Brooks Beast organization has been around since 2008, I think, or so. But Jesse Williams spearheaded Brooks's attempt at being competitive and going head to head with Nike, which then created the kind of environment that someone like On is at. So the Beasts are equal to Nike, equal to On, except that they don't have quite the same kind of financial. Their coach, Danny Mackey, is one of the great coaches who coaches the 800 through the marathon or 800 through the 10K in an incredible way of doing it. But Jesse Williams found Danny Mackey. He founded that program. And then he left there for whatever reasons. We don't need to get into that. But because he was such a track fan and he wanted opportunities for people to see it, he just created this brainstorm of doing a world-class 10,000-meter event that just put on the greatest 10,000 meters we've ever seen in the history of the 10,000 meters in terms of sheer numbers of athletes that have run fast.
Yeah.
And this guy just made it up. You know, you start, and Jesse, I've known him for many, many years. He's a wonderful and incredible human being. And I'm just so, this is what I mean by the sport changing. There's money, there's eyes, there's attention, there's storylines. We've got a chance in the next 5 to 10 years to elevate this sport to the next level. While Kara's being a great commentator, we need even more commentators. We need some of these young commentators to come up through the system and know more and be better and better and to get to the world level. These things are happening. And so I'm just like, Michael, this is the time to be a track fan, because you'll look back on this when you're in your 50s and your 60s and your 70s and say, I was a track fan when the golden era of track and field was happening. And I believe that we are right now, especially in the distance races, in the middle distance races, we are in the golden era of the sport of track and field. It's the best it's ever been.
I love it, man. That's so badass. All right. I think we did the 10K some serious justice.
I hope so.
I like it. Is there anything else that you want to end on that we... I'm kind of stoked on it right now.
No, I just wanted to highlight the women. I just wanted our female listeners that may have felt that it gave short shrift to the women. Wasn't because I don't think that they're equal or equally valid, but just that we have a limited amount of time and it's hard to get through all of it. And we'll work harder in the next cycles as we go through the 5K and beyond and below to try to give equal value to both of the two competitive fields, because we value that. I value them, and I know many people value them equally. And I just wanted to make sure I said that, because I didn't want it to be seem like we didn't care as much.
I know some folks that are probably like, well, tell me the story of the women's history in mm-hmm. totality. It's like, yeah, we should.
Well, I think we'll get the opportunity now that we've opened this door. When we see competitive events and we have questions, we can talk about that. I think we'll also maybe do a couple of special episodes as we approach the Olympic trials, and then a special episode as we mm-hmm. approach the Diamond League races that are going on, and then the Olympic Games themselves. Be able to talk through those and talk about how those played out. So, you know, it's impossible to tell the story of 10,000 meters in an hour and a half. It's just not possible. Yeah. But I did my best, and I'm sure there's others who will listen and say I could have done it better. But if you think you could have done it better, then do it, because I would love to listen to it. I promise you, I'd listen to every minute of somebody else's statement.
Let's go.
And I'd be a fan of it. So I just feel like, as you said, this isn't available. This kind of a primer on the 10,000 meters isn't available anywhere that I've heard of. And so this is unique. And hopefully people found it valuable.
That's what's up.
Cool. Godspeed, y'all. Thanks for listening. Take care.